5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom.
On this lunar mission, Josh and Blockade talk to special guests Ingmar and Ori. We hear them wax poetic about NYC and the crypto scene there, and we also learn about how they first met. We get their take on some recent crypto current events, and talk in depth about the DeFi space, DAOs, and what projects they're hyped about in 2020. We also hear about their thing, Deorg, which is a full-stack Ethereum development agency that's also run as a DAO, which I think is pretty cool. We also hear about some of the projects they've worked on and some of the companies they've worked with, and also hear about their new thing, DAO Launcher, which really simplifies the process of launching a DAO, which I think is pretty cool and a good thing for the DeFi space. After the interview was over, I couldn't believe it, and I said to myself, DAO, that's amazing. As I thought about a decentralized future, on the dark side of the Huddle Moon.
Brought to you by SpectreCoin. SpectreCoin is a proof of anonymous state coin. So it's got ring signatures, it's got stealth addresses, it's got a Tor obfuscation already built in. And like I mentioned, it's a staking coin. So this is a passive income coin. If you just hold and stake, you receive more coins. It is ultra secure, ultra private. Your financial privacy is at stake. Like Bitcoin, but private. Like Monero, but with staking. SpectreProject.io.
Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com. All right, and we're back with another episode of Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. I'm Blockade, the Huddle Warrior, and I'm here with Josh Argo. Josh, how are you doing today?
All right, Cade. I've heard that this coronavirus has spread even further afield than before. I mean, we were recording this a few weeks ago. We were kind of laughing it off, and let's say you're not laughing now, are you? I mean, America's really being hit.
Yeah, we're on different sides of the world. So in Korea, where you are, it's kind of toning down. And where I'm, it's ramping up. But don't worry, I've got lots of food, ammo, gold. My private keys are locked away. So everything's all good here. I also got like a couple extra handles of whiskey. So I don't care if it's a two-month hard quarantine police state. I'm ready for it, Josh. Don't worry. But speaking of quarantine and things in the U.S., actually, I'm just outside Providence. So it's really not bad here. But we do have a couple interesting guests that are kind of in the heart of it in the crypto space and also when it comes to the pandemic. So without any further ado, we have Ingmar and Ori. How are you guys today?
How's it going, guys? Good to be here.
Doing well.
I'm currently in a bunker in the middle of Long Island, New York, just kind of escaping the, you know, the dense part of the
Is the it affliction. True that people are really like hoarding toilet paper and things like another non-perishable food?
Absolutely, man. I thought I acted early, and like maybe a Thursday or two ago, the supermarket was just the line went from the front register to all the way in the back, like in the frozen section by the milk.
Yeah, I mean, the Koreans are kind of finding it bizarre because they're just like, just wear masks and wash your hands. And why is everyone hoarding toilet paper? So that's been kind of like a local meme that's been spread around the Koreans. Like, what's wrong with the Western people?
Yeah, we lack in chill.
Yeah, and, for sure. And Ori, are you quarantining and chilling? How are you where you are?
Yeah, I'm at an undisclosed location in South Florida. Not my usual stomping ground. I'm supposed to be heading to Brooklyn, but, you know, New York might fall. So doing quarantine out here, weather's nicer, and there's more toilet paper.
Yeah, do you have like a gator moat around the secret location?
Yeah, there's gators everywhere. It's the only way I feel safe.
Right on. All right. So enough about that. Let's talk about what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about crypto and the crypto space. So maybe Ingemar and Ori, maybe you guys could tell us a little bit about yourselves, your backstory, or maybe how you met, and we can kind of go from there.
Word. So I was a solo digital marketing consultant with just like the hobby of reading white papers and learning about crypto and like early to mid 2017, I think. And I started going to meetups, and there was, you know, I started to get a feel for the scene and what types of personalities were there. And we went to this, I went to this club called 4040 by Flatiron, and it's very like loud and boomy hip hop music and like guys in suits with drinks and mostly people just talking about like whether Bitcoin will hit 100,000. And I was just at a table, like chilling with a dude who was like my friend for the time being, you know, just kind of pass the time. And Ori passed by, you know, dude in just a sweater, probably on his way out. And I just said, hey, man, what are you up to? And that kind of struck the conversation. I think he'd just moved to Bushwick at the time. And I don't know if you want to continue, Ori, from your perspective.
Yeah, yeah. So at the time, Ingemar was in digital marketing and was just interested in crypto. And then I was actually already working at a crypto firm and had been like in and out of the industry for a couple of years. So by coincidence, like a week or two later, someone in one of the Telegram groups I was in was looking for like a marketing director. And I kind of like connected them to Ingemar. And then, yeah, he was there for a while. And that was like his first step into crypto. And since then has like gone crazy with like a million different awesome projects. And now we're finally collaborating again on a project that I started with some other people about a year ago called Dorg. But yeah, my crypto story starts in like 2014. I was at a University of Virginia. A friend told me about Bitcoin. A cryptography professor there happened to be teaching a course on it that fall. And so I took the course, despite not having the prerequisites. Ended up, because of that, majoring in CS in computer science in addition to the anthropology degree I was doing. And yeah, ever since I've just been like interested. In undergrad, did some like research projects, and then since then have like worked in the industry. And yeah, my interest originally was with Bitcoin and kind of like extensions of Bitcoin into like not one-to-one transactions, but like many-to-many kind of interactions. So like saving money with a group of like 20 other people and having permissions for removing the money from the pot. So I was like figuring out ways to do that on Bitcoin. Also did some research on crypto incentives in the Tor network, which is the anonymity network that people use to access the dark web and just browse the normal web anonymously. So looked at like crypto incentives there. There was a lot of problems, but yeah, now I'm like mostly focused on Ethereum stuff.
Right on. And what was the original project you guys first hooked up on?
I think technically it was a startup that Ori was working on. I don't know if you want to say the name,
but sure, yeah.
It was called. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. This company Atlas that was focused on like crypto digital banking in West Africa. And so there was like a paper we were working on, and Ingemar helped us out with like editing it and all that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So that was like my first little dip. Yeah.
You could revisit that in a couple of years, because I think that's where adoption needs to go, those type of places. I found you know, you've got Singapore and New York and London, and you've got like kind of bankers 2.0 that want to like make blockchain into this suit and tie type of activity where you meet and do like the normal Wall Street thing, which I don't think it should be that. I think it should be in the cradle of civilization in Africa. It should be in Southeast Asia. It should be in the places where people don't have bank accounts, but they've got phones. So I think that's the big adoption place. Maybe you could revisit that in a couple of years after DeFi's developed a little bit more.
Yeah, I think we're early and the rails are getting kind of there to the point where it can operate in like low bandwidth, like low connectivity environments. But that was the biggest problem. Yeah.
Anthropology is pretty interesting. So anthropology plus computer science. So would you say that blockchain is kind of like applied anthropology? Like you're basically testing out different theories on different groups of humans. It's quite interesting.
Totally. It's like the perfect crossover. And there's a couple that I explored. Like I was at a human-computer interaction lab, which is kind of like another way of intersecting them. I worked in digital humanities, which is like the application of machine learning to text. So like looking at like thousands of Tibetan texts and extracting topics from them using machine learning. So those are kind of like different sorts of combinations, but crypto for me is the most interesting because it's like real world. You're throwing out experiments in the wild. You're seeing how people react. There's kind of these like complex dynamics that are unpredictable with like, you know, actors that are not like centrally coordinated. It's just kind of like culture, kind of like human language and all the other aspects of culture.
Speaking of culture, we had a place over in Bushwick that was sort of like a developer, like, or any fan, like an epicenter for anyone who was interested in crypto or just general development. There'd be like weekly gatherings. It was called the Bushwick Generator. And, it was run by this guy who like does real estate. And he has this space that, you know, he uses to just kind of foster like collaboration and just blockchain related conversations. So he's a chill dude. Shout out to Emmerich. So that was a space where a lot of developers working on their own projects would just kind of like sit together and, you know, sometimes share ideas, sometimes work quietly for hours. I know Ori was there like almost every day. You know, and I would pop by in. It was a very chillax environment.
Nice. And what's the New York blockchain scene like these days? Are there a lot of meetups? Is there still a lot of interest? And what do you make also of like the New York regulations? It seems like it's pretty stringent there in New York.
Yeah. So the first question, I did go to a Crypto Mondays like 2 Mondays ago. And there was surprisingly like a dozen and a half people that were there for crypto. And obviously there were just like other people who just wanted to get drinks at the bar. So it felt like a full-ish event. I mean, not too full that you could keep a 1 meter radius, right? If you really wanted to, but there was enough people there to have some discussion there. Like everyone's scared, but also like, you know, there was still a scene. It still felt like there was a scene. The second question, I forgot what it was.
Oh, what do you make of the New York regulations? It seems like compared to other states and jurisdictions in the U.S., it's pretty stringent, pretty crazy there.
Yeah. They had this thing implemented, especially for New York, called the BitLicense, where if you run like a blockchain company, you actually can't have it. You can't have the office in New York. So yeah, like if you got caught, like if someone were really wanted to dig up some dirt on you and like ruin your whole business, like that was a liability in being in a startup like that. But like the way Celsius Network, I was at Celsius Network for a while. The way they dealt with it is they established an office like with a mailbox and like actual location in New Jersey. And they, you know, they try to have some people just like show up there and like conference into New York. So there were some workarounds that we definitely had to do. They didn't want blockchain stuff happening.
No, it's like every Chinese exchange. I mean, they're all registered in Singapore, but all the staff are in Shenzhen. So who knows how that works? All right, cool. Well, that's interesting. So you guys met in that type of scene. And then what really brought you together to decide to work on this new project, DEORG, which stands for... decentralized, or is it distributed?
It's a mystery. It could be no. So it's like a decentralized or distributed organization. Also, cool. I've heard that it might be digital organism. So it's up to you. But yeah. So I was like early on DEORG, like about a year back, with someone I met in Prague named Jordan. And so he had been working on some like open source tooling for DAOs, which are decentralized autonomous organizations. So like basically companies or organizations or communities that are totally based on on smart contracts. So like all the conditions, all the rules are programmed in for how the money and the decision making and the power can get like reallocated. So yeah, he had been working on some tooling like in the Colony ecosystem, which is a DAO framework we can get into later, and also in the DAO Stack ecosystem. And so like I joined up with him, and we started kind of like really thinking about how we could take this thing into the real world. Like, so rather than just be like a side project in a hobbyist community, kind of like make it something that like real communities, real businesses, real governments are using to like operate transparently, efficiently, democratically, meritocratically. And so we like started this hacker collective called Dorg out of that. And then more recently, like, you know, it's been a little bit over a year now, and in the past 6 months we've more like professionalized, you could say, and had to like take more seriously like our sales and customer support and recruitment and onboarding and all that sort of stuff. And that's where Ingemar has come in recently to help with that kind of like professionalization. Like, he's had a lot of experience in both crypto and non-crypto, like biz dev, sales, marketing. So yeah, recently like we kind of struck a way for us to work together. And then the nice thing about like a DAO or like a digital like crypto based community is, as you guys know, they're very like amorphous and people can join in and leave. And there's this culture of being remote, being, you know, like non full time, like a lot of people who can just like work part time on certain things. So in that way, like Ingemar and us have always been collaborating, but it just became kind of like formalized recently.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of the most appealing things about the industry is the remote nature of it. I mean, now everyone's kind of forced to be remote through this coronavirus thing, but a lot of people will see the benefits of it. And I think it will become something that will be demanded in the future. And I think the crypto industry was one of the early industries that really pushed remote work. I mean, I've got a background in remote work because I was playing poker in Thailand like 11 years ago. So I definitely love remote working. I think that's one of the things that drew me into crypto. Cade, you've got a couple of interesting questions to throw in the works here, I think.
Yeah, well, before we dive deeper into Dorg, I kind of want to get either one of you, if you want to give me your take on what you thought of the recent drop in the market. I know you guys are both big fans of like DAI and the DAO and like, you know, smart contracts. And I think with that recent market drop, like, you know, it affected the collateralization of the loans. And I just kind of want to get your take on it. Do you think it's just a temporary drop, and any other comments you have on it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised because they falsely thought that like Bitcoin and Ethereum and crypto is like an uncorrelated asset, but it's not. Like, when people need cash to pay for their expenses or to like close up like leveraged positions like that are falling throughout the market, you know, they need like cash, they need the reserve currency of like the world or the country they live in. So yeah, when things are dropping like crazy and there's an actual global slowdown, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum fall with the rest. What I've like kind of come to, it's become more clear to me kind of like through like reading and thinking about it and actually experiencing it, is that like the power of like, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum and other currencies as like these like autonomous, like community governed currencies, is that they're not uncorrelated with the market, but they're not a hedge against the stock market. For example, they're a hedge against inflation. They're a hedge against like government control of money. So it's not like during the fall of like these past couple of weeks that we're going to see crypto rise. It's in the aftermath of that, when the Fed has flooded like $2 trillion more dollars into the, you know, into the supply. Yes. And people are losing faith in fiat. That's when
all the printing. Yeah. That is exactly what this
have
is
you,
about.
Have you guys seen that new meme, money printer go brr?
Yeah. Yep.
I think it's also worth noting that like a year and a half ago, Bitcoin was at 3,000. And without a pandemic. So like we've been hit, you know, with this craze and like doors are shutting, restaurants, bars are closing, you know, people are frantically running around for toilet paper. Bitcoin is like double of the low it was a year and a half ago. I think that says a lot about its strength.
Yeah, I mean, people can't remember that far back. People can't remember what, you know, they did yesterday. They're too busy scrolling on Instagram and Twitter.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the biggest point. Exactly right. When you talk about all the new money that's been printed, that's where a lot of it is going to end up in cryptocurrency. So it's going to end up in Bitcoin. It might end up in Ethereum and other digital assets, which is going to cause a massive rise in the price.
Yeah, so. And I agree with Ori too. Like, when people need money, need cash, they're just going to sell their crypto. But as for me, you know, I'd sell my blood plasma before I sold any of my crypto. That's for real.
I think we all agree with that.
That's so funny. So, like, I also have a podcast that I did for a while, and we had a guest on there that actually did exactly that. Like, he would sell his blood plasma to, like, get more money to invest in the Ethereum presale, like, 5 years ago.
Oh, yeah. He must have been a poor college student just saving, you know, saving his fiat and converting it to crypto. That's pretty funny.
I would do something less extreme in college. I would do these rhinovirus studies, which is, like, the common cold, where they would just basically put, like, the cold up my nose and get me sick for a week and then hand me $1,000. So I was like, hell yeah. Yeah, I'll get the cold.
You're a medical test experiment. Like,
I'm immune from Corona and all that by now with all the shit they put in me.
Yeah, that might be like a weird kind of vaccination that you've been going through. You know, you're going to be invincible.
We'll see.
You've got the invincible antibody.
Yeah, nice, that's interesting. Nice. I mean, that's definitely an American thing, you guys, what you were talking about, because in the UK, you can give blood, but they don't give you cash for it. They just say, thanks for being a good citizen. You know,
Josh, we're a capitalist country. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that's true. We've got a socialist NHS that sometimes works occasionally.
Yeah, $20 is $20, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
For real. So, yeah. So it sounds like I knew you guys were big into, like, DeFi and DAO and Ethereum, but it sounds like you guys are kind of well-rounded. You also are big fans of crypto as cash or Bitcoin as a store of value or as a hedge against the Fed going absolutely loco. Because sometimes we have people on, they're Bitcoin maximalists or they hate Bitcoin or they're Ethereum only or Bitcoin only. Like, for me, I like Bitcoin. I like Ethereum. I like altcoins. I'm kind of a fan of a bunch of different use cases. And actually, until recently, I wasn't really hot on DeFi, but it sounds like you guys kind of like different parts of the crypto space. You're not like, you know, maybe your job, your company, you're laser focused in one area, but, you know, outside of your job, you kind of have interests in other areas of the crypto space as well.
Yeah, I really like that crypto is just a blank slate, like, playground for creating whatever you can dream up. And so Bitcoin is, you know, the first one, and it's super interesting, and I think it's going to just stay around forever, and it has that meme of, like, scarcity, and that's great. And then we have Ethereum, which is, you know, trying to be, like, this world computer, you know, Turing complete programmable money, and that's great. And then there's all these other experiments going on, and I'm really familiar with the stuff going on top of Ethereum, and some of it's, like, wacky, some of it's, you know, bad code, bad economics. But, you know, out of all those experiments and all those failures, we get a lot of super interesting projects, which we can get into. But, like, you brought up Maker and DAI, and it's, like, a very sophisticated, like, algorithmic, collateralized, you know, decentralized bank for maintaining a peg. And that's, you know, maybe that's just, like, a balloon waiting to pop. And it almost did this past week, as you mentioned. But, you know, even if it fails or succeeds, it's going to be this super interesting kind of piece of history to, like, learn from and build on top of. And so, like, yeah, I don't think there needs to be, like, a winner take all, like, it's this coin or that blockchain. And, like, it's just it's really cool to be like, okay, anyone, we democratize the ability to, like, print money to create economies. You know, it's no longer just the providence of, like, of a government that has, like, a monopoly on some area of land to do money. I think we all agree with that. And so, like, when you see the tribalism, like, yeah, it makes sense because people really care about the things they're building and investing in, you know, shilling their bags. But I think everyone can agree we're stronger together, you know, even at times, especially when times are good, we fight with each other. But when times are bad, like right now, I feel like the fighting subsides, you know.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, you kind of hold hands and sing a cryptographic song together. I don't know.
beep beep.
And Ingemar, you said you used to have a podcast, and that's no longer a thing, or?
Well, we're distributed now, so I got one friend. He's a podcast mate. He's in Munich. He's trying to come back, actually. And it's just a matter of us getting together again. And it's like, it's way funner when, you know, when everyone's in the same room and there's like a real energy share when you do it. I mean, like, this podcast is great. Like, I'm having, like, I feel like we're in the same room. Like,
oh yeah.
Especially seeing all your faces.
I appreciate that. You know, as far as Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon, we're never ending. As long as crypto's around, as long as the blocks are still being propagated, we're here.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
I want to ask another kind of more broad question. So, besides your specific projects, like, what are things you're really excited about in 2020?
I'm curious to know, like, how, you know, Vitalik's map of like Ethereum 2 pans out. It might go long, you know, it might take longer than just this year. I'm curious how the market responds when this pandemic, you know, subsides a little bit. It, you know, it could take a while. But I think a lot of people are going to retain that culture, that like this virtual culture, and like become really, really comfortable with it. Just because like, I've got a pretty big group of friends in New York. Some are in crypto, most of them are not. And like, we do like to get like gather together. But we had like our first call with like 7 or 8 of us just like video chatting, and it felt like hanging out. Like, video chatting for me is like, is either like a business thing, or like there's a bunch of like cousins and aunts and like grandparents like saying hi, I love you, and it's just chaos. So like, this will kind of teach us to like interact and like, you know, through technology, and just kind of get comfortable with it, because it's pretty efficient, and like, you know, it's all we have, you know, when we're separated by like global pandemics.
Definitely. And whether you're in the same city, or a lot of people aren't in the same city, you know, I'm talking to friends, you know, I used to live in France, I used to live in Korea, family all over the US. So yeah, that video chat kind of, that visual component kind of adds a little bit to it. And, Ori, how about you? What are you excited about in 2020? Are you excited about DeFi in general, or any other projects with, you know, smart contracts or in the Ethereum ecosystem that you are a fan of?
Yeah, definitely my eyes on like DeFi, which I'm kind of only indirectly involved in. My project's more like DAOs, which I could talk about for a while. But in terms of DeFi, like, we really saw DEXs take off this year. So liquidity slippage was always a problem, like, unless you're just going to like Binance or OKX, like, and now we're seeing Uniswap this past year. Like, that's my go-to. If I'm trading tokens, like, I go to Uniswap and I don't have to log in, I don't have to do KYC, and it's like very low slippage. And that's just crazy. That was like unthinkable a year ago.
I've heard several people mention Uniswap. Can you give a brief description for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, sure. So it's a decentralized exchange for ERC-20 token swaps. So it's based on Ethereum. And so you can trade any two, it's like one-to-one trade. So I can like get a good price for trading, let's say like 5 ETH for however many DAI, or even like wrapped BTC. So there's like exposure to BTC on Ethereum. And so you can like kind of trade from a USD pegged coin to a Bitcoin pegged coin trustlessly. Like it's custodial, it's non-custodial, so you know, it's your keys, your crypto, and it never leaves your wallet. It just, like, the logic in the smart contract just takes the swap at the current price, and there's incentives for people to market make and to provide liquidity. They can get a fee from that, and the whole system is like super non-involving humans, basically. Like, they don't even have an upgrade key. It's just like they put it on the blockchain, and it's just there forever. And like, if they ever upgrade, they'll, you know, just encourage people to go to a new system. But it's just there, and it's like you don't have to hope that Binance doesn't disappear overnight. You have
keys. Yeah, I'm a, you know, fan of DeFi in general. But yeah, the wrapped assets, the wrapped BTC, and other chains have it too. A BCH has like an SLP wrapped BTC. EOS has a wrapped BTC. So that's kind of a new general thing. But yeah, they have wrapped BTC on a bunch of chains right now. So I have one other question before we take a deep dive into this DeFi stuff, kind of a fun one. So I don't always ask this, but I'm kind of wondering, is there anything you were just spectacularly wrong about? And can you look back at it in hindsight? Maybe you have a funny one, or maybe you were part of the crowd. I think for me, obviously, I was, you know, in 2016, 2017, 2018, I'm like, this thing's never going down, or hey, it's going to be, you know, I thought it was going to be six figures by now. That was maybe one big thing I was wrong about. And I also thought it would like spread, the ecosystem would spread. It wouldn't just be like Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum, Cardano, BCH, Litecoin. I thought it would be like spread out more, where it's kind of like, it's kind of become to like, you know, Bitcoin is getting a bigger part of the market share. So those are just some examples of things I've been wrong about. But is there anything you were wrong about and you were kind of surprised or shocked or just sad because you were hodling some shitcoins?
Yeah, for sure. Basically in the same vein, like 2017, utility tokens, reading tons of, you know, papers about like white papers about specific ones and just general like Medium posts about like the economics of utility tokens and like price velocity and all this stuff, and being really sold on it and really thinking that I was like a VC analyst capable of looking at a white paper and doing some due diligence on the team, going to their LinkedIn and their GitHub, and then thinking, cool, this is legit. The token economics makes sense. And just like, I didn't actually participate in any ICOs, but, you know, just like buying it off an exchange and just losing every time in the long term. And so that was like, it was such a useful experience, because now that we're all still around, the next time there's any sort of mania like that, we'll have a little more pause. And there's going to be a whole new wave of people who are not going to have that. So yeah, I was totally wrong about that. Now I can go more into why I just think ICOs are like flawed as a mechanism. But yeah, it didn't click in the way it should have.
Yeah,
go down that route. Go on.
Wait, I want to hear what Ingemar okay. was wrong about first.
Then come back to the ICO thing.
Oh yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. So yeah, I guess a couple things. Like, yeah, I remember keeping up to date on like Quantum or Qtum and like Neo and like based like other protocols that try to be as big as like Ethereum or Bitcoin. And, you know, I thought the networks would be just as big in those communities as Ethereum and Bitcoin, but they never were. I feel like there's only room for like two or three, like, you know, protocols that are kind of, that'll kind of carry the way. Like, we still hear about Stellar, like people build like a lot on Stellar. But like the other ones, you know, I thought it could be any of them in 2017, early 2018. But now it's like people only talk about like new innovative stuff on like built on Ethereum.
Yeah, like part. Yeah, everyone was saying like what's going to be the Ethereum killer? Is it going to be Arc, Lisk, Cardano? And like I was like spread out, like one of these platforms is going to be, you know, the big thing. I got to have exposure to all of them. So before we get into Ori's issues with ICOs, I want to know what kept you in the crypto space. A lot of times when the market just bottomed out, like everyone left, you know, the conferences had, you know, 20% of the people, 25% of the people. So what kept you in the crypto space? You kind of touched on it maybe in the beginning, but was it the money? Was it like, it's exciting, it's new, it's interesting, you can change the world? Like, why are you still in crypto in 2020?
Yeah,
pardon me. Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically the first thing I could say is just so going to meetups and conferences, you realize that this is like the weirdest, smart, excited, like Wild West kind of group of people. And so you have the good, bad, and ugly, and it's just like a million miles an hour and things change so crazy from week to week. So just that in itself is something that keeps you around once you're in. But in addition to that, just being like, I see the potential in this so clearly, and even though it's gotten fucked up, you know, left and right, you know, the potential is still there. It's unchanged. The core value proposition is untouched by all the craziness. So that's just it for me.
Yeah, and for Ingemar, are you all about the Satoshis? Like, why are you still here?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I remember being to the point of like, oh shit, that's my savings. It's dead. I'm dead. I'm dead. I'm not selling at this point because it would be terrible. I'm just gonna die with the ship.
It's never over if you hodl.
Yeah, like, but I've been to the point where it's like, yeah, I'm ready to die with the ship. I'm like facing it. There's nothing left to do, and so I'm ready for the zero. Like, ready for the zero, and then it doesn't hit the zero, and then, you know, life creeps back in. And also, like, I've made friends along the way. So it's that, you know,
that's the quote of the night. Ready to die. Hodl or die, baby.
Oh, man, hodl or die.
There's been a couple of coins. I mean, these days they tend to do a bit more DD before they list coins on the bigger exchanges like Binance. But I remember in the early days of Binance, when Binance coin was like 12 cents and stuff, they were listing coins that were, let's say, less than reputable. And there was a couple of Chinese ones. And I remember buying that at like $1.30 a coin. And then 2 weeks later, it just went to zero and was delisted.
Ouch.
Yeah. That was my best fail. Okay. We've got to get into ICOs. Oh, yeah. Go on. Right. What's your best fail?
My weirdest like exchange experience was like on HitBTC, where like I bought this token called Sun Contract for what it like $600 worth, and then like I withdrew it and they gave me the same number of tokens but like in a completely different token that was worth like 10%, so like I got back like $6. But like in the same wallet, same number of tokens but like a different, completely different ticker. Oh, man. On it.
I mean, we've all got our stories, but we can share them at our own discretion.
Well,
yeah.
Well, Kate's got a couple of interesting
ones.
Yeah, Ori was talking about the wild, wild west of the ICO space, and actually, Josh knows a little bit more about it than me, but I've heard a lot of stories and saw some things and heard some things on the show and behind the scenes. But I just want to know, Ori, do you want to invest in the 2020 ICO of Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon?
All in.
Yeah, baby. But seriously, what is wrong with ICOs and why aren't you a big fan of them these days?
All right. I'll go on my rant about this. I'll try to make it real quick. But basically...
Long rants only.
All right, I'll keep it long then. But so the ICO in a nutshell is give us a bunch of money and we'll give you this unit of value. And we promise that over the next couple months and years, we'll create a system where the only way to get into that system is that token we gave you. And then there's a limited supply of them. So the value will go up as people want to use this system we just built. That's like every single ICO, as far as I know. And so what happened in 2017 is that we were all so infatuated with the systems they were talking about. They were like, oh, whoa, the system is going to give me like file storage or privacy, or it's going to mow my lawn or whatever the fuck. And we forgot about like, oh yeah, but there's nothing like making that team, like incentivizing that team to actually deliver, because we just handed them $10 million. So even if it's not like a straight up exit scam where it's like, you know, they raise $10 million and they disappear, even if they're like a super well-meaning team that's experienced, you know, there's no like, there's nothing pushing them to deliver, you know, so like in the traditional startup world, you know, you have like people from the VC who invested in you are like then sitting on your board and have like powers and veto rights and they have actually like you have a fiduciary obligation to them. So you have like a legal duty to deliver to them. And if you start, you know, veering from that, they can sue you. And so there's all these like pieces that like tie back the injection of money into the delivery of value for the people who injected the money in the traditional world. And we just totally forgot about those in the ICO boom. And we just said, okay, we'll throw the money. And yeah, they have a bunch of the tokens. So they're incentivized to build the thing that makes the token valuable. But you know what else they have? The money that you just sent them.
And they have the bags.
They have the bags. So so, you know, it worked a couple times. Like Ethereum was started through an ICO. There's a very small number of you know, token projects and new blockchains that actually delivered, kind of, you know, none of them really had a return, but that actually delivered on the promise. But you know, the percents, you know, probably below one.
from mid 2017 onwards, I think that almost all of them haven't delivered very much. But some of the very, very early ICOs did deliver. So like the ones back in 2016, the return on that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's not to plug any particular project or not, but the super early ones were really good. But then when people realized, oh, wow, this is a money printing machine, a lot of companies and projects started to basically come up with fancy white papers, great ideas. And there was almost a formula to it, like make sure the LinkedIn looks nice, because people were doing their research by clicking on LinkedIn and spending 7 seconds per profile or whatever, browsing through. Oh, story checks out. And then, all right, I'm ready. I've got my theory.
I'm all in. Mortgage the house, all in on YOLO coin from the 20th page of CoinMarketCap.
You're completely right. And Dennis Lewis, we had him on the show. He's the author of Behold the Cryptopreneur. And he actually talked about he wanted to call it a DISO, so a decentralized ICO, where basically all of the money that was gathered would be locked in a smart contract, and the community would have to basically vote to say that certain milestones had been reached before different parts of the money were released to the teams. Because the biggest problem was, if you just give $50 million to a guy in a shiny suit, and he might not be inclined to finish the project. He might be inclined to go straight to the Black Sea and go on a yacht. So, and that's where a lot of them ended up going, the Black Sea, on their yacht, and never actually built anything, which is a shame. But going full circle then, well, let's go into from what was supposed to be like a decentralized way of funding, of crowdfunding some type of a project. Now we can go into what Diorg does a little bit, which is about DAO. So let's talk about one particular thing right now, which is the DAO launcher. And just for the audience to clarify, what is a DAO?
Sure, I can try to tackle this. So just a DAO is just decentralized autonomous organization. So it's basically a group of people, humans, who are managing decisions together, and usually those decisions are financial. So the simplest way to think of it is it's like a multi-signature wallet. Like a multi-sig is the MVP DAO. So like, you know, there's like $100 in the pot, and the four of us each have one vote, and to take any money out of that pot, you know, you need 3 out of 4 of us to vote or something like that. And so that's like the baseline. But then, you know, it gets interesting when you add more dimensions to that. So like, maybe you have 36 votes, I have 35 votes, you have 55 votes, and you have 2 votes. And so, and maybe our votes are dynamically changing based on how often we vote correctly. So you can just kind of go crazy with the complexity of it. But at the end of the day, it's like there's some like set of conditions responsible for like executing decisions we make. And those are all encoded in software that lives on a blockchain.
Nice. So where does DAO Launcher come in?
Yeah. So that's a tool that we developed for basically anyone to easily launch what I just described. So launch a DAO with you know, different amounts of voting power for different people, and that's able to do actions like move the money around that's in the DAO, or change up the voting power. So like you could say, you know, we all started with 100 voting weight each, but now we want to make a proposal to give Ingemar 20 more voting points because he did something we think is useful, or he like put more money in or something like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the DAO launcher is just like the attempt we made at making like the simplest way, like in the space, to make a DAO, because it's really hard to make a DAO. Like we made ours using the DAO stack framework through the command line. So we're all developers, our team. And so, you know, it was not trivial, but it was also not impossible for us to do it. But for a lot of people, it's just like, where do I start? How do I launch a DAO? And so like, there's a couple of DAO frameworks out there that makes it easier, like Aragon, DAO Stack, Colony, Moloch. And so we made the DAO launcher as basically a way to launch a DAO stack DAO really easily. And so that's just one of these frameworks that you can kind of like plug and play different parts for your DAO. Yeah.
So for your DAO launcher, like, what is the minimum skill required to launch a DAO? Do you just need to be computer savvy? Do you need to be a beginner programmer? Like, what would you say, like, you know, my grandma can't even find my podcast, so I'm not going to send her there. But can you tell us, like, who could make a DAO? Is it pretty easy?
I think if you can create an Ethereum wallet, then you can create a DAO. And, you know, there's some helpful, like, I wrote a pretty helpful article on how to do it step by step with pictures and everything. It's really like a quick form, and like the most complex part is like adding the wallet addresses of each member in the DAO. So, and then you just push a button, and then you're on a dashboard. You can start a vote. You can add funds to the wallet. You know, so it's pretty intuitively designed. And you know, the way the smart contract works is that, like, once funds get into the DAO's wallet, nothing can leave the DAO wallet until a vote is passed by everybody. So I think that's the cool thing.
Nice. I've had an idea for a smart contract for a while. I want to get your guys' take on it. So if you guys remember back in the day, you got a lot of scammers, I'm sure, like, hey, send me 0.25 Bitcoin, and in 2 months you'll get 2 Bitcoin, or, you know, we'll triple it in 3 weeks. So what I wanted to do is, when they tried to send me these scams, I wanted to send them a smart contract where I would put in 0.25 and they had to put in, you know, a full Bitcoin, and at the end of the contract I would get it and they would get mine. Would that be something possible to do?
Well, Bitcoin doesn't have the best smart contract scripting language, so that could take some time. But if you did it on Ethereum with WBTC, with some wrapped Bitcoin,
wrapped BTC, or a stable coin, or Ethereum, or ETH, or anything else like that. Yeah, I'm kind of using Bitcoin as a placeholder for all kinds of crypto. But
that's interesting. I actually really like the idea of wrapped assets. I mean, we had a guy on a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago now, talking about wrapped DAI, which is really interesting. So I think that wrapped assets are really going to be something that will push DeFi even further, especially when you could have wrapped dollar equivalents and being able to do a lot of, like, programmable dollars, which is really interesting, and programmable money. And he often used the term money Legos, right? And I don't know if you guys in New York are using the same terminology. I don't know if you guys call it money Legos or not in the DeFi space in New York, but
money
that's
Play-Doh.
Really interesting. What do you call it?
Money Play-Doh.
It's Play-Doh.
Yeah,
Play-Doh. You can make it anything you want.
It's more malleable.
Money Play-Doh.
Okay, that's even better. It's far more malleable than just already predefined blocks of Lego. That's interesting. All right, so what do you think? Where do you think that this can go in the next, let's say, I don't think developers are very good at doing time estimates, you know, so that's why Scrum was invented, to get away from waterfall and all that type of thing. So let's bring it out to 5 years instead of what's going to happen in 2020. Where do you think DeFi will be in 2025? And what type of things will the average person be able to actually do with DeFi products?
Yeah, for DeFi, like, I think a lot of the stuff that we see that's really rudimentary out there today and, like, getting hacked all the time, we'll just see, like, working versions of that. So recently, there was this protocol called BZX. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's like a derivatives protocol on Ethereum. And you could basically put shorts or longs on ERC-20s. And so, like, I had a long position on Ethereum, you know, like a 4x leverage. You know, it goes up 20%, I get an 80% gain. It goes down 25%, I get wiped out, right? So it was great. It's really interesting. You know, if you're trying to short something or, like, have, you know, more leveraged exposure, you could use that. But then during ETH Denver, actually, while I was in Denver, and actually the whole team was in Denver for that project, the whole system, I'm not gonna say hacked, but the whole system got, like, very intensely manipulated to the point where the attacker got about $300,000 worth of ETH out of the system. And they basically did that by, like taking out a loan on one protocol while paying back the loan on a different one, and then manipulating the price oracle on a different one. And they were also, like you said, money Legos. They were also interconnected, that you know, this attacker just found like a couple weaknesses in the different ones and then manipulated them
this
all.
This was the flash loan thing, right?
Flash loan thing, yes.
On top of compound.finance, and then he exploited this flash loan, and in one single, it's like a batched transaction in one single, like...
Something like 8 atomic actions in this one single atomic transaction.
So one batch, one transaction, and then they committed these 8 different things that went off in line like a domino effect, and then boom, 300K.
And the cool part is you can see the log that the attacker did. Like if you go to Etherscan and have that hash, you can see like every single thing they did, and it's just this train wreck right in front of you. And I remember being at Denver and having an open like 4x position on ETH. And just being like, oh my God, like I'm never getting that money back. And it was like a week of trying every day. And like, it really felt like I was back in 2017, like in some shitcoin trying to sell it. But I think DeFi is at that stage right now where ICOs were a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think like, you know, the Ethereum and the DeFi space is kind of like Bitcoin. Whatever doesn't kill it makes it stronger. And obviously, some of the hacks have really sucked. But, you know, obviously the security is going to be a lot better in 5 years. So if we can wind it back a little bit to the DAO launcher, can you tell me, it seems like it's relatively new. Can you tell me a little bit more how long it's been around? Like, have a lot of people been using it? Like, what has been the response?
Yeah, so we released actually like a first version something like 8 months ago, and it was what we call now like the advanced version. So it just kind of exposed all the different parameters of the protocol and said, you know, you can tweak this and this and this and this and this and explain every single thing. And the feedback we got from that is like, it's just impossible to use because we actually like designed it from the perspective of the protocol. We were all very deeply familiar with like the DAO stack framework and all.
So people, the feedback was too many variables?
Yeah. They were just like, what does this mean? Like, I don't want to read a 30-page paper to know how to like just launch my organization with me and a couple friends or something. So
UX is key, user experience for sure.
Yeah. So we made that mistake of designing it from the protocol perspective. And then what we did with this new version that Ingemar was referring to is we designed it from the user perspective. So we talked to all the people who had like used DAOs before. And just made it like literally, if you really wanted to, you could do it in like 30 seconds with 3 clicks. So like it's simple by default. If you want, you can expose all that complexity under the hood. You can take as much time as you want to learn about it. But if you just want to get something up and running, you know, throw some test funds in it and start like managing funds with a group of people, then we kind of made it for that purpose. So that basically you can focus your attention on like the interesting part, right? Like, what's our business model? Is there fundraising like related to this? How do we manage our community rather than like the nitty gritty, like, you know, tweaks you can do to the speed of the voting and the sensitivity, like to betting markets and stuff like that.
Yeah. And beyond the feedback on, you know, tweaking it a little bit, have you seen a lot of use, or do you kind of see it as still really early in the DeFi space and you're kind of building something that when the crowd comes, you're going to be ready? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's still very much at the hobbyist stage with the DAO stuff. So it's only the people who like already were interested in DAOs are now using it. We don't track like usage stats. We can like look on the blockchain and see how many like times the contract's been hit. But the cool part is that people are just like I'll just find out about a DAO that was like launched a couple weeks ago and that already has a couple members and has some funds that it's managing that was used our tool to launch, and then like we had no idea, which we should probably get better at, you know, tracking that stuff, but we just kind of put out the tool first. So but it's still at a stage where like the business models aren't clear, the use case isn't clear, so we're seeing stuff like, I could back up and just say, like, Diorg is a developer shop. You know, we're an Ethereum dev agency. We work with clients to, like, build, like, DeFi stuff, DAO stuff, Web3 tooling, smart contracts. But we run ourselves as a DAO. So we're actually dog food, and we're using the tools that we're kind of excited about. And so, like, the first use case we saw that was interesting because we're devs was, like, running a dev collective. Yes, but let's use a DAO for that. And it actually made sense because the tooling was so bad that only devs could really interact with it. But now that the tooling is getting a bit better, like we have this DAO launcher out, like we're seeing kind of more interesting, like real people stuff coming about. So like, for example, there's a there's an events production collective called the DAO Fest. And so they've run like something like 100 or so events around the world in the last like 6 months. And it's a group of non-technical like event producers. They put on conferences. And so they're using a DAO to like sponsors pay money into the DAO, and then they get a set package and they get their logo on events. And so an event producer can say, hey, I'm running an event in Singapore this week, and makes a proposal and gets like enough money for pizza and beer and the like booking the event space and maybe some compensation for their time. And so they developed this whole model around getting revenue in through sponsors, getting money out to people producing events. And it's just really cool to see those kinds of things take off, but we're still not like sure what the, you know, the niche will be or the like use case will be.
Yeah. I think it would take a lot of time. I'm sorry.
Go for it.
I think it would take a lot of time to get enough like relevant data to see like what kind of impact these DAOs will have. Just because I think the reputation system is built for, you know, like long term, like how much are you contributing to the decision making, and you know the point system is supposed to like kind of be based on like, you know, your reputation, and like, you know, decisions are weighted by like how much you've contributed to every decision that you've done in the past.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I just want to touch on what you were kind of alluding to there is like there's kind of a big disconnect between, let's say, the people that are using the tools, the devs, the programmers, and then let's say like the marketers, which are used to very like UI, UX friendly type of programmable, well, not programmable data. Let's say they're used to programs that are so intuitive so that when they can market to people that people can use them immediately. But many of the DeFi products, you need a certain level of technical competence before you can even start to interact. So I think the next 5 years is going to be about chipping away at those UI UX issues, that because the actual like the plumbing is there, the plumbing is there underneath the surface, but when you have to interact with it, like a lot of people just give up because they have to either, let's say for example, you have to sync to the, you have to run a node and it takes you 2 days to sync with the network, for example. Most users are just going to say what's going on and no way. Or the other side is you need to be able to run something like even something simple like MetaMask to be able to interact with Ethereum. And people are just like, this is too confusing, I don't get it. So I think the next 5 years will be closing that gap between the devs and let's say the real world people, that with the help of marketers. And I think that's where you guys have got that together now, which is really interesting. You're trying to like pull those forces together to make it accessible to the everyday person, which is super important. Now, do you think that in 5 years' time, a DAO will be as simple as like a Facebook group or something like that, setting up a new group on Facebook? Is it going to be something as simple as that, or do you think we still have a really long way to go?
5 years, definitely. With how quickly things are moving, like me using, like I've been getting paid completely from a DAO for over a year now. Like, and doing that like a year ago was painful and scary. And now it's like a lot better. I can already see it. So in 5 years, for sure. I think in the next 2 years, we'll see like, something not mass market, but mass market for crypto, maybe that's like non-technical, that has like hundreds of people in it that are just there for shits or for money or whatever, and it's actually doing stuff, and it's just like a Facebook feed, and you're just clicking like and vote yes and vote no. Or yeah,
I think another cool thing is that the DAO launcher that like we have currently, like when you make a proposal and it gets passed, you can actually like share it on Facebook or Twitter, like, oh, this thing got passed and this is what it looks like. So we're kind of there at the Facebook group level, you know, of efficiency. We're closer than you think.
Yeah, definitely. Josh loves to look 5 years in the future, but I want to go back to 2020. I want to go back to current year. So I want to touch back on what Ori said before, So am I getting this right? D-Org is a full stack Ethereum development agency that's run as a DAO that created the DAO launcher. Am I?
That's right. DAO.
Am I putting my blocks together in a chain? Does that make
sense?
That's
a blockchain. Sounds like a blockchain. And So there's two sides to it. It's like we're an Ethereum dev agency. And so like, for example, our clients, that's what they care about, that we're like high quality dev shop, communicate well, deliver on time, document our code. Our clients don't care that we're a DAO. Like, we don't advertise that. But the DAO is what like lets us operate really effectively and have like self-motivated developers. And it actually helps us attract really good developers, because really good developers don't want to be an employee a lot of the time. They want to be like a freelancer or founder or CTO. And so like our system allows everyone involved to kind of have that role. Like, I'm not, I don't have any privileged position, even though I was like one of the first members. I don't have any special powers that like a new member has. Maybe I have like fractionally more influence, but I don't have like a veto right that they don't have.
Okay. So could I call you guys like programming guns for hire that joined a DAO? And like, normally you'd just be like, you know, looking for the highest paycheck, but somehow you're able to work together through this DAO to make bank, whether it's fiat or crypto, or taking that fiat and converting it into crypto. Would that be a good way of putting it?
So, Cade, have you seen the movie The Expendables?
Yeah,
like Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wait, I don't know if I've seen that one. Maybe does it have a sequel too?
It does. I think it's even got three. Yeah,
maybe I saw the first one. Yeah,
it's basically like every action hero star you've ever seen in a movie are all in one movie as like mercenaries for hire. That's D.O.R.G.
We're the Avengers.
I love it.
So you guys like self-assign roles. Are you basically like, all right, today I'm going to be a product manager type of role, today I'll be the scrum master, today I'm going to be the technical guy? Or does it have any kind of resemblance of a traditional structure with a CEO, a CTO, like a CFO? How would it work? Because that's the one thing that people kind of don't quite get about decentralized organizations, or even flat organizations in general. How do they work, especially from a startup perspective, where one of the appealing things for many startups is that they say, look, we've got a flat structure, but eventually you have to have a hierarchy in some regard so that things get done. So how does a DAO overcome that?
Yeah, despite not having hierarchy, we do have specializations. So, you know, we have someone who's a couple people who are really good at like Solidity, smart contracts, and like people who are like React wizards, and myself, who's like focused on like legal, admin, biz dev, like, and so like when opportunities come to us, like we kind of like say, okay, I'm busy with this, I'm gonna throw this to this person, or but to get more specific, like we do have like squads or units that break off to like manage projects. And so usually what we'll do is for each project, like each client project has a team lead. So that's a person who's kind of like communicating with the client, taskmasters, like a project manager. So that, like, for the sake of efficiency and convenience, there is like a go-to person for accountability, but that person can't like fire someone on their team. You know, they would have to like make a proposal to the DAO, like, hey, this person isn't delivering, I think we should slash their rep or not pay them this time. So we have like specialization, we have structure, just it's more like amorphous and like self appearing sort of as the needs arise. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds like too good to be true, and it is. It's like, it's way harder in practice, so it's a constant process to like get better at that. But what kind of helps it all stick together and keep making progress is that everyone is like a co-owner of the firm. So we're all, you know, stakeholders, none of us are employees. It's a self-owned kind of like a developer cooperative. So, you know, we all have a stake. If things get better, you know, the rates we're making go up, like our stake in the thing becomes more valuable. And so we just kind of do everything with like a mechanism design philosophy. So, you know, we don't have enough developers, so we have like a recruitment fee commission that people can earn. We don't have enough client projects coming up, so we have like a sales commission. And so incentives alone don't drive things. I think it's people who like care about the same thing. So it's like that plus incentives and different mechanisms to make things work from the bottom up.
Right.
Nice. So, it's really interesting. I noticed that just on the main website, they have a join us thing. You can just apply it to join this organization.
Yep. So we have like a transparent onboarding process. Like anyone can fill out a form, tell us your specialties, and the group will get like an email with like your information. And then there's this whole process that you can look in our, we have like a handbook. So anyone can go and see like, oh, what's this all about? How do I join? And we have a bunch of bounties up. So anyone who like submits a bounty, like, hey, I did this work that you guys wanted someone to do, we'll look at the quality and say, okay, do we want to like let this person in? Is it a good fit? Do we have like projects they could work on? So it's kind of like always open, always taking on new people, new projects. It's like
spontaneous order, you know?
Nice. Full disclosure, while you were talking two times ago, I actually applied and I just put HODL in every question. But if I don't hear back from you guys, I won't be hurt. So
I'll put in a good word.
Well, you know, maybe we can talk about that. We could send some projects your way if we, you know, because we talk to a lot of people in the crypto space. I'm sure if things line up and if they're looking for that type of skill set that you have, that stack of skills, then we'll send them your note, no problem. That's pretty interesting. So given today's current like disaster movie scenario that we're living in, the pandemic era with people staying at home and things like that, remote work has really become a hot issue. It's in the news. People are talking about remote work, and there's been articles from all of the mainstream media about 25 ways to be more productive at home and top 10 remote tools to, you know, keep sane while you have to be self-isolated. But you guys have been a remote decentralized team for quite some time already, so I would like to ask you about your remote tools. What's your type of go-to stack of, let's say, technology tools that you guys use to work as a team to make sure that things are going well in a decentralized organization?
Yeah, that's a great question and one we kind of struggle with all the time. But our current stack is Keybase for chat. We use Jitsi for free video, so kind of like a open source Zoom. And we use like GitHub projects for like task management and all that. And actually we use GitHub sort of as like our ERM, like enterprise resource management, like all our legal documents, budgets, invoices, everything is in a private GitHub that our whole team has access to. So we lean super heavily on GitHub, Keybase for chat. But yeah, it always feels like the tools aren't good enough. We're always talking about, you know, screw this. Let's just like drop everything and make our own tool stack that's better for remote. That's like so tempting. But, you know, you can't burn the oceans. You got to focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of programmers say. The tools aren't good enough. That's what Vitalik screamed at the sky when he was trying to do these things on Bitcoin. And then he did his own thing.
All right, so that's interesting. So you don't use any of the like quote unquote, let's say, traditional stuff, like maybe this sounds ridiculous.
We do use Google Sheets for like tracking.
There we go.
Like,
I was gonna say G Suite. Are you not using G Suite? Are you not using Monday.com?
Oh man, like, we have a big debate right now about G Suite. We're not using it, but it's so much better for a lot of stuff. So don't get me started.
Like, we use Microsoft Teams at Salamantex, and I personally like using G Suite. We use G Suite here at Dark Side of the HODL Moon. When it comes to like more decentralized projects, then it just comes down to the preference of the programmers, really. They're like, oh, I'm used to this. I use Discord, so we're on Discord. Or like Keybase, I don't personally use that, but a lot of developers like to use that. So I can understand why you guys use that. So it's kind of just like, it's not really a planned thing. It was just kind of like, that's what all the members used already. Let's go for it. That type of thing. So maybe that could be the next step in your business, refining that a little bit more, getting that process down. That's one of the hard things about having a startup, because you're only a year old now, Diorg. Is there any of these projects that you've worked on in the past that you can go into detail and explain what you did for them, how you helped them? What was the process of finding those clients and then them deciding to work with you? And then what was it like, the development stage? So maybe you could choose one of these examples on from your website as a case study and walk us through like that whole process, how that from start to finish happened.
Sure. Yeah. One good example is that people might be familiar with is the Graph, which is like querying and caching protocol for blockchain. So currently just Ethereum, but I know they're planning on kind of being a query layer for more blockchains. So yeah, they've gotten like real traction in the last like year and a half. A lot of Ethereum protocols have like a subgraph implemented, which is a way for their dApps to run quicker because the data is coming from something that's caching all the blockchain data rather than needing to read the blockchain directly, which is not optimized for like read queries at all. And so, yeah, we were at a hackathon and had been kind of going after one of the Graph's bounties. Just we had an idea for a project we wanted to build that would kind of improve the functionality of the Graph. It would like add not just reading capabilities, but also write capabilities. So instead of just being able to read data from a blockchain really efficiently, you could also like write a series of complex write actions, like transactions in a single query. Like in it's called GraphQL is the language they use, which was open sourced by Facebook. So anyways, we did that hackathon and then they were really interested in it and ended up contracting us to add that support to their protocol. And so we kind of from end to end, we're able to spec out the whole thing, like go really into depth with their CTO and their whole engineering team about the requirements, like their processes for changes to the protocol, which was like very like well defined and strict. And then kind of like do a lot of feedback back and forth on the technical specification. And then over the course of like I think 3 months, because the specification was a month, and then 3 months we added basically write support to what was only like a read-only protocol. And so kind of like almost doubling the like usefulness of this already kind of like massively used project. And so we're just starting to, we're like releasing a blog post soon on like how developers can add this support to their dApps. And so it enables something really that people aren't used to in crypto, which is like optimistic updates. So like in Facebook, if you like something, you'll instantly see like the like count go up by one, even though Facebook servers have not updated yet and like adapted that global state to have one more like. But they have this whole like system because they're using GraphQL where they can like optimistically update it, whatever. So now you can do that with blockchain apps. So even though it takes like 15 seconds for your Uniswap trade to go through, you can see like it instantly, like as a user, you can kind of like optimistically just have a smooth experience. And you'll just get a warning or something 15 seconds later if the transaction fails. So that's just an example. Yeah. So we're rolling out like, it's in production and it just need to get like more developers using it. But that's a good example because not only was there like specification and implementation, but now we're also kind of like helping out with kind of getting the adoption of like the thing we built for them.
All right, cool. I don't know if someone's in a restaurant or something. Some people nearby. Anyway, but that's cool. I really like that idea, especially just from a user experience point of view. That is the number one thing that is preventing mass adoption, in my view, of cryptocurrency. Even if the on-chain transaction hasn't yet occurred, it needs to have the feeling of it happening already. So that optimistic way of doing things is quite interesting. I'm really glad that you talked about that, because that is the biggest disconnect between, let's say, the marketing people and the programmers, is this UI UX thing. And when that is resolved, I think a lot of adoption can come, because the users are just so used to everything looking and feeling like it's seamless and perfect as it is now with current products, that for blockchain to have a chance, they need to basically replicate that user experience. So I think it's very important. I'm glad that you guys are working on that. All right, Cade, do you have a couple of questions lined up in your top pocket there?
Yeah, well, we can just do a couple more and we can wrap it up. Yeah, I look at the website. You work with a lot of big companies. I'm curious, you mentioned ETH Denver and like some of the other hackathons. Mm. Do you by any chance know Victor Rojvet?
I do not, not personally.
No, I think he was at ETH Denver and he did a project. I was just kind of curious. Beyond that, I'm just kind of curious how big the Dorg team is, and did the team expand or contract, or did you guys just do side work? Like, how does it work with the with it? Do you like, can you, you can vote for someone to join? Can you vote to kick someone out? Like, how does the deorg thing work? Is it, you know, and you've also mentioned these different frameworks. Is it like, do you have a bigger weighted vote because you were earlier? Is it by how long you've been there, how much you've invested in it? Like, how does that kind of stuff work?
Yeah, I'll start with the second question. So we came up with this simple, dirt simple mechanism for voting power, which is every dollar you earn, you also earn a share. So continuously, we're minting these shares, like voting shares, as we're doing paychecks, essentially. So, you know, today, for example, I did a proposal to pay myself, like, let's just say for simplicity, like $1,000. So let's say it was 1,000 USDC or 1,000 DAI. In the same proposal, I also asked for 1,000 voting shares. And once that passes, now I automatically, the DAO transferred $1,000 to me. It also gave me 1,000 more voting points. And so continuously, like, everyone's earning money, asking for money. They're also asking for voting power. And so you can see, like, it has this dynamic where the voting power is inflationary. So if you stop working, we actually don't really, we haven't had to kick anyone out because essentially if they just like stop getting their proposals approved for work or they're not doing work, they'll gradually get diluted. So it started off with like, there was three of us. So it was like, we each had 100 voting shares, right? So we each have 33% power. And then over time, as we were like doing, doing proposals to get work, like, you know, gradually get diluted. So an interesting thing happened like three or four months ago where finally, like, up to a point, like the two founders could override everyone else, which makes sense in a startup. You know, usually it's just one person can override everyone. But so with any, like, we could shut down any vote, we could pass any vote. So but actually today we have like something like 21 rep holders. We have more like 10 active developers and like three or four non-developers that are active. So but anyways, like three or four months ago, it got to the point where the two of us needed one other person to vote with us, to swing the vote. And now it's way less, more than that. Like, we need four people plus us two. And a lot of times us two don't even vote because the group has enough voting power. So like over time, as like more people are providing value to the group and getting paid for that value, they're also getting voting weight. So it kind of naturally decentralizes over time, which is a pretty cool mechanism that I haven't seen kind of done yet.
That's nice. Impressive. I can imagine, like you mentioned before, the recruitment fee. I imagine like there's not a lot of blockchain and Ethereum programmers that use these languages like Solidity and some of the other languages. We actually talked to someone earlier who did Jtherium, which allows you to make smart contracts in Java. But it's kind of seems like, you know, if you want to make some bank in 2020 and beyond, like, learn how to program on the blockchain. And maybe join a DAO like deorg.
Yeah. Also, it's worth noting that you can't like just repeatedly create proposals, like asking for money, like endlessly, because it does cost like just a little bit of Ethereum to make every proposal. So like it's enough to like make it annoying. It's like 50 cents or 80 cents like each time you do it. So it's not like you can just keep like, you know, asking for money.
Yeah, I mean, that's enough not to spam the network. I mean, I've seen things where people are saying that email should be like a fraction of a penny so you don't get spam email. Well, that really, I don't have any other questions today. I think that was a really interesting conversation, but
I liked all this topic. DeFi is where we should keep on pushing. I think we need to talk to more DeFi people. I think that DeFi is going to be massive in 2025.
I want to leave Ingemar and Ori with the last thoughts. If there's anything else you want to talk about or mention that's coming up or things you're excited about, and then we'll maybe wrap it up.
Sure. Thanks again, guys, for having us on the podcast. This was super fun. It reminds me how much I love like podcasting. You can follow us on Twitter, dorg_tech. You can follow me on Twitter also if you feel like it. Ingalandia, Ingalandia. Dorg.tech is the website, and Ori, if you want to plug anything else.
Yeah, just if you want to reach me personally, Ori@dorg.tech, and otherwise go to our website, you'll find everything.
Also, if you are looking for a development team, you can email me at ingemar@dorg.tech with questions.
Awesome. Well, we'll put all of those notes in the show notes so you'll be able to check out what these guys are doing. And if you want to reach me, I'll post my Twitter as well, but I probably won't respond because I'm in quarantine on the dark side of the Hoddle Moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehoddlemoon.com.
Hoddle Moon!